Evicted in Rio, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Summer Games officially kick off tomorrow in Rio, but not everyone's happy about it, including one woman who had to leave her home to make way for an Olympic venue.
She was really shocked to see how fast the tractor took her house down. She said it felt like her heart was being destroyed.
Plus, in Canada, an effort to get hunters to see things from the bear's point of view.
It's like someone walking into your kitchen or your dining room as you're eating breakfast or dinner and shooting you. It's obscene.
And Japan's newest hero is a sad and cranky egg.
This is a cartoon mascot that's literally retreating into a shell, the same way that you want to do when you hear the alarm clock go off on Monday morning.
That's ahead on The World. We're about 24 hours away from the opening ceremony for the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio. The athletes are already there, and some of them have even started their competitions. And the host city of Rio de Janeiro is scrambling to get every last thing ready. In a moment, we'll be talking about some of the non-sports concerns that surround these Olympics, like the fear of Zika. First, though, I want to check in with our man in Rio, the world's Will Carlos. He says the mood in the city is festive. You could say even holiday-like. And Will says that's in part because today actually is a special holiday there.
This is largely to deal with traffic and also to try and foster, you know, the Olympic spirit. There's a municipal holiday across Rio, as there is going to be throughout the Olympics. So the schools are closed, a lot of businesses are closed. Obviously, some things are still open. But the idea is to keep people off those streets so that the tourists, the athletes, everybody can get around.
Now, we're going to hear about one of the big issues in a moment, Zika, with Dr. Anthony Fauci from the National Institutes of Health. But I want to talk about something more in popular culture. The New Yorker is out with a cartoon cover of sprinters swatting bugs away as they race. Give us a reality check. How bad are the mosquitoes right now?
Well, I actually think that cover, my personal opinion is that cover's completely misleading and indeed a bit silly, really. I mean, there are very few mosquitoes in Rio right now. They're still around, but I mean, compared to the summer, very, very few mosquitoes. I can't remember the last time I saw a mosquito. So, yeah, I thought that was a little kind of irresponsible, to be honest.
We're also hearing that there are still millions of tickets that have not been sold. Is there a plan to fill the empty seats?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing pictures on social media of literally empty soccer stadiums as the first soccer game comes out. I believe that they've started giving away a lot of those tickets to school children and other people in Rio. But, you know, it's kind of too little too late. I guess there are just some events. I mean, you know, Iraq versus Denmark male soccer obviously isn't a big draw in Rio. I think things will, plus a lot of people are still arriving. So I think I'm hoping that these stadiums fill up to get the kind of optics a bit better going forwards.
Now, Will, there's good news for you, of course, with the IOC announcing that surfing will be in the 2020 Olympics. I know you're a surfer. It's got to be good news for you, right?
Actually, it's kind of, I'm kind of split on it, to be honest. I noticed, for example, there's a lot more people surfing this morning. Now, that is because it's a holiday, but I think this is probably going to give a big boost to surfing, get a lot more people excited about it. You know, as surfers, that's not the best thing because we don't want too many people in the water. You know, I think a lot of sort of people who surf a lot would actually say, you know, let's get the sport to be as unpopular as possible so that we can get more waves. But that's a very selfish way of looking at it. I think for the industry, this is an interesting thing. I think for the games, this is going to be great as well. I was at the press conference all day yesterday. I interviewed the head of the International Surfing Association, Fernando Aguirre, who's actually an old friend of mine, and talked to him about this. And he's really excited. And there's a feeling that the Olympics has to do something to appeal to sort of the younger generation. And bringing in surfing, skateboarding, speed climbing, bringing back baseball and bringing in karate, I think, are all going to be moves to kind of bring more people in.
And finally, what can we expect from tomorrow's opening ceremonies? Will Giselle grace the stage?
Who knows? There's a lot of speculation. There's also speculation about whether Pelé is going to be there. I know he had been invited. Pelé, obviously, the great soccer player from sort of the 50s. He is expected to be the guy who lights the Olympic flame, but there was some controversy about whether he's going to be allowed to do it by his sponsors. I can't see why a sponsor would not want him in that position. But yeah, there's going to be some surprises, and we're all excited to watch it.
the world's Will Carlos in Rio. And by the way, you can follow Will all during the Olympics on Twitter. He's at Will Carlos. That's C-A-R-L-E-S-S. Now to one of those issues that have clouded the run-up to these Olympics. I'm referring to the thousands of Rio residents who were forced from their homes to make way for Olympic facilities. Evictions like this have happened before other Olympics. Host cities rarely have enough open land for all the stadiums, athlete villages, and roads required by organizers. But in Rio, while the government did offer evicted families compensation or new housing, many don't think they got a fair deal. That's according to reporter Julia Afeone. She grew up in Brazil, and she spent the past month in Rio hearing the stories of residents who fought the relocations.
It was very hard to find these people because there wasn't a place where all their contacts were listed. And also, they were sent to places that were really far away from where they used to live before.
Give us an example of a person you found who'd been evicted.
I talked to this woman, a 40-year-old babysitter called Conceição da Silva, and she was evicted from Vila Autódromo, that was this community that is the neighbor of the Olympic Park. And Conceição used to live there in Vila Autódromo for 19 years. She had all her friends, all her community ties, where she basically grew up. And Conceição was really shocked to see how fast the tractor took her house down. She said it felt like her heart was being destroyed. Now she's living in Parque Carioca condo, which is not far from Vila Autódromo, but she doesn't have the community interaction that she loved so much about Vila Autódromo.
Are her actual new accommodations better in terms of the quality of the house or more modern?
Her new apartment is very small, it's very dark, and she says that she doesn't feel as welcome there because when she gets home, she doesn't have like her friends on the streets, she doesn't start chatting with them or stop for a snack or beer with her girlfriends like she used to do in Vila Autódromo. She feels very isolated in her new apartment.
Did City Hall go to people like the woman, the babysitter you spoke to, and say, we need your home, it's going to have to be demolished, we're going to give you this much money? Was there a sort of formal process?
There was a formal process. In Vila Autódromo, the residents organized themselves and they resisted very fiercely against that. But in other places, like in Vila Harmonia, for example, where I also talked to a woman that was evicted from there, Miss Elizabeth, she said that the whole process took only 2 months. There was some meetings with City Hall in neighbors' houses. And then one day, she got a call saying that she had to pack all her stuff, yeah, that the moving truck would get there the next morning.
Were these people paid? Did they get anything for having to losing their homes?
Yes. Depending on the place, they had different compensations.
People getting displaced for Olympics, it's not an entirely new story. I think it happens in every city. What's different about how Rio handled it?
I think Rio has this fame of being a marvelous city, and this marvelous city is denied to these people that were evicted because of the Olympics. So some of them lived right close to the beach. They had public services close to them. They could easily get a transportation and go to the city center. And now they were took from that place where they built their lives.
Did you encounter any individuals in your interviews who are going to fight back?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Conceição, in fact, the babysitter that I was talking about, she was one of the last people to leave Vila Autódromo. They were really organized. They received a lot of support from local activists, artists, and they formed this organization, this really solid organization that allowed 20 families that remained, that refused to leave, they managed to stay there. City Hall ended up giving in and building new houses for these 20 families that stayed. But in the beginning, in Vila Autódromo, there were 500 families. So the fact that these 20 families stayed is the proof that more families could, in fact, have stayed, like Conceição herself.
Julia Afeone is a reporter who grew up in Brazil. She spent the past month in Rio hearing stories about those who've been displaced from their homes to make way for the Olympics. Thanks, Julia.
Thank you, Carol.
We mentioned Zika briefly a few minutes ago. Concerns about the virus have hung over Brazil in the lead-up to the Rio Olympics. Some top athletes have even opted out of the Games, citing concerns about Zika infection. The virus has been linked to the serious birth defect known as microcephaly. But science moves slower than fear, and researchers are still working to understand both the link between Zika and birth defects and the risk to visitors to Rio. Dr. Anthony Fauci from the National Institutes of Health joins us for an update on the science. Dr. Fauci, how certain are we at this point about the link between Zika and microcephaly?
That's really gotten to the point of being incontrovertible. There have been a number of studies showing the direct link there, and more information that accrues confirms that link. So I think that's something that really we need to take off the table now. There's no doubt that there's a link between infection of a pregnant woman, particularly in the first trimester, but even beyond. There's no doubt about that right now.
For a pregnant woman who is infected with Zika, how high is the risk of the baby having a birth defect?
We know there is a definite association. One quite good study was done in Brazil, and it showed that there was anywhere between a 1 and a 13% chance that a woman infected in the first trimester would get a microcephalic baby. It is very likely that the percentage of women having some fetal abnormalities that might be more subtle is going to be a percentage that's somewhat higher. And that's one of the reasons why we're doing what we call large cohort studies, prospectively following 10,000 pregnant women, in which we're going to try and determine that exact percentage incidence.
Now, Rio itself is not in the hotspot area for microcephaly in Brazil. It's mostly in the Northeast. How worried should people be about going to the Olympics?
It depends on who, quote, people, unquote, are. Pregnant women should not go to Brazil now. When you talk about other people, if you look at the incidence now in Brazil in August, it's dramatically less than the incidence of Zika that was seen in January and in February. So although there is still obviously local outbreaks there, it is significantly less, almost certainly due to two factors. One, a substantial proportion of the population has already gotten infected, so the ability to spread has toned down. And second, it is their winter now, and so the mosquito density is considerably less.
Now, as we've mentioned, the high rates of reported microcephaly in Brazil have mostly been in a few states in the Northeast. And that's got some Brazilian health officials wondering whether Zika alone is causing microcephaly. Might there be another factor involved?
Well, there certainly might be cofactors that worsen the situation or make it more frequent. The economic conditions, the underlying health of the individual, the prenatal care of an individual. There's a whole variety of things. But as I said, the primary cause of microcephaly is the virus infecting a woman during her pregnancy.
Zika was first thought to be transmitted by just one kind of mosquito, but now it's been found in a second type of mosquito that has a much bigger range here in the U.S. What are the implications of that for Americans?
Well, you know, from a practical standpoint, overwhelmingly, when you have mosquitoes of the Aedes aegypti, which is the predominant transmitter, and you have in the same area Aedes albopictus, which is another mosquito which can transmit, overwhelmingly, it's the Aedes aegypti that does the transmission. So I don't think we can make much out of the fact that other types of mosquitoes can transmit it when practically we're seeing a virtually exclusive transmissibility by the Aedes aegypti.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the Infectious Diseases Institute at the National Institutes of Health. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You're tuned to The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the evolution of consumer preferences to the reasons for price swings in the oil market, tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
Over in Japan, Hello Kitty's been a national pop icon for years, but many Japanese now have a new favorite cartoon character. His name is Gudetama, and he's a sad and cranky egg. Yep, a depressed egg who hates waking up in the morning. The World's Patrick Wynn looked into why Gudetama is so popular in Japan. Patrick, what is it about this cartoon egg that has everybody so obsessed?
To play pop psychologist, I think Gudetama is capturing something in the zeitgeist, you know, that feeling where you want to retreat into your shell. You know, this is a cartoon mascot that's literally retreating into a shell, the same way that you want to do when you hear the alarm clock go off on Monday morning.
So it's not any more than that? It's not sort of like malaise and depression?
I mean, if you wanted to look a little deeper, you could think about the fact that we don't live with our families as much anymore. People live more isolated lives. Maybe Gudetama is capturing that. I'm not sure. But, you know, I think the overarching point is that in Japan, it's not unusual to have a sad cartoon character. Like, it's a little bit odd in the U.S. It's not so much like that in Japan.
How would you describe the character for our listeners who've never seen the egg?
Well, picture sort of a formless yellow egg yolk with a face that's usually sort of wincing. He's always sort of laying on the ground like he's sort of wallowing in the unpleasantness of existence.
You mentioned that sometimes cartoon characters in Japan are sad. What's that about?
I spoke to this guy named Matt Alt, who's a specialist in Japanese culture based in Tokyo, and he explained it like this. You know, if you were to buy a stereo in the U.S. and you look in the instruction manual, it might say, don't put water on your stereo, the end. In Japan, you might see a picture of a cartoon stereo with water splashing on it, and the stereo is screaming out in pain. He says, basically, in Japan, cartoon mascots are used to express all emotions, including negative emotions, including constipation. You might see a poop character at the pharmacy. Talking about constipation is kind of unpleasant, but this cartoon character kind of smooths that conversation over with your pharmacist.
What was the context for the introduction of this character? How did people even encounter it?
The character was created by Sanrio, which is this Japanese corporation that does pretty much nothing but create interesting characters and license them out to other places. So you can make Hello Kitty notepads or Gudetama pencils or something like that. So they gave the public a large number of characters to choose from, and Gudetama was picked in an election, and he actually came in second. So people responded to this character. It wasn't something that this company just forced at the public.
Who came in first?
I think it was some sort of talking salmon jaw. And there was also a talking block of tofu in there as well. Gudetama trumped both of those characters.
I understand the Gudetama craze is global. Where can it be seen in Japan and around the world?
You can now see Gudetama all over Asia. You can actually buy Gudetama dolls in the U.S. I first saw Gudetama in the wild at a Circle K mini mart in Hong Kong, and I walked by and didn't get it at all. Why is this depressed-looking egg? Actually, I thought it looked hungover. Why is this hungover egg plastered in the window of a mini mart? Is that supposed to make me want to buy something? The answer is yes, it was supposed to draw my eye, and here we are. I'm talking about it on the radio, so I guess it worked.
Patrick, have you yourself fallen into the Gudetama frenzy?
He certainly caught my eye. I don't own any Gudetama merchandise. I think that's more geared towards the type of person who might look natural walking around with, say, a Gudetama iPhone case. I don't think that's a great look for me personally. I don't have any Gudetama swag.
Patrick Wynn is the world's Asia correspondent. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
I've got Nina Porzucki in the studio with me. She's one half of The World in Words, our podcast about languages and the people who speak them. What's going on, Nina?
This year, we've been doing a lot of stories about how activists around the globe are bringing languages back from the brink. Languages like, you know, Irish, Lakota, Hawaiian. And Hawaiian, actually, is what we're going to talk about today. Ooh. It's often talked about as the poster child of language revival gone right. But it turns out reviving a language isn't so simple. It creates divisions. Earlier this year, I took the journey to Hawaii.
That was a tough assignment.
It was a really tough assignment. And I met with a man by the name of Larry Kimura. He's an associate professor of Hawaiian language at the University of Hawaii in Hilo on the Big Island. And he is also sometimes called the grandfather of the Hawaiian revitalization movement.
Well, you will be publicizing a new name for me. The Godfather.
The Godfather.
Of revitalizing the Hawaiian language.
Okay, why are you taking a new name?
Godfather is more accurate.
Wow. Is Larry a native Hawaiian speaker?
No. Larry's experience is pretty typical. His grandparents spoke Hawaiian. He did not. In the 1960s, when he set out to learn the language, he saw the writing on the wall. Native speakers, they were getting older, and without a major effort, the language would die out. So he and a group of activists started a concerted effort to save Hawaiian. They started a Hawaiian lexicon committee to coin new words like computer or cell phone. They opened preschools to teach their children.
How did that work?
It's working. It's working really well. Today, the largest group of Hawaiian language learners are children. But here comes the complication.
All right, lay it on me.
There's actually a group of Native Hawaiians who have never lost the language.
Really?
Yes.
What's that?
That is a Ni'ihau hula. The Ni'ihau are from the island of Ni'ihau. It's a privately owned island 17 miles off the coast of the island of Kauai.
Did you say privately owned?
Yes. The island of Ni'ihau was purchased in 1864 by Elizabeth Sinclair. She was a woman from Scotland, and she bought the island from the Hawaiian royal family. However, little wrinkle, when Elizabeth purchased the land, there was a whole community of Native Hawaiians living on the island, speaking Hawaiian. And that Ni'ihau community still lives on the island, and they still speak Hawaiian.
It's amazing.
And the thing is, when I spoke to some of the Ni'ihau, they were skeptical about the language that Larry Kimura, remember, the godfather, and his colleagues were reviving, and those new words that they were creating in the Hawaiian Lexicon Committee. Here's Ni'ihau speaker Luana Kenahele.
They're the professor.
Yeah.
Yeah? We're talking about people with degrees. Yeah. They can create whatever and however they want. For me, as a Native Hawaiian, am I going to stand in their way because they created all this word?
No.
No, I won't. That's fine with me. Because that's not in my dialect. That's in your dialect.
So do you even consider it Hawaiian?
No.
Ooh. At this point, there's two very distinct Hawaiian dialects developing then.
Well, that's a controversial statement. It kind of depends on who you ask. Division between native speakers and folks like Larry Kimura, who learned Hawaiian as a second language, isn't a unique division to the language of Hawaiian. This is something that happens in many languages that are being revitalized. This week on the podcast, we're actually going deeper into this divide and the issues of who gets to direct the future of a language.
Sounds really interesting. I'm definitely going to listen. You can find the World in Words podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, Nina.
Thanks so much, Carol.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Just ahead, we get up close and personal with a grizzly named Bo Diddley.
Bo and I go back 10 years, so he was just a little scrawny thing back then.
How big is he?
He's probably an 800-pound bear. I don't know. He will get larger, but he is bigger than most.
That's a lot of bear. Coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's easy to ignore from halfway across the globe, but the fact is the war in Syria doesn't stop. In the northern city of Aleppo, bombs rain down from the sky every day. In recent weeks, government troops have cut off the city's main roads, while Syrian and Russian aircraft pummel rebel-controlled portions of Aleppo. When those residents who remain in the city hear the buzz of planes overhead, most dive for cover. That's not the case with a group of volunteers known as the White Helmets. They rush toward the destruction, and they pull bodies from beneath rubble, hoping to find someone still alive. Earlier today, I spoke with one of Aleppo's White Helmets, 29-year-old Ishmael Al-Abdullah.
The last few days was like hell for all the people in Aleppo City. We can't bring any food, we can't bring any supplies for the hospitals. We have heavy bombing in Aleppo City, and a lot of people were killed just yesterday night. All the people in Aleppo City who are living now are the poorest, most of them widows, orphans. The electricity went off 2 days ago, and we don't have any electricity in Aleppo City. The darkness is everywhere. the situation has become worse and worse and worse. The streets are empty of people. The market is closed completely, completely. I haven't seen any bread. I haven't seen any rice in all Aleppo City. All what we have now is just bombing, bombing, bombing. The people now are so scared about their futures, about everything. This nightmare has become so close to them.
Ishmael, when was the last time you went out as a white helmet civil defense worker?
Just yesterday.
And what did you find when you went out?
We went to the west neighborhoods of Aleppo City, and we found a lot of buildings collapsed because of the bombing. We worked for more than 10 hours to pull out the bodies from under the rubble. We have 10 people were killed, including the 3 kids.
Did you find any people who were wounded that you could save and get to some medical help?
Yes, we did yesterday. We have the wounded people, and we took her to the hospital, and actually she's alive now.
How soon after a bombing do you go out and try to find people?
Actually, I give you an example. We our job every day to track the choppers, to track the warplanes. Then when they hear that the airstrike bombing one place, we wait for another attack because we know that when they bomb a place, they wait for us to get there and they bomb another bomb. So we wait some minutes to go to the location. After that, maybe we are working in order to get someone, maybe another airstrike will be, and we know that another airstrike maybe will hit us. So we withdraw, then we complete our job another time. This is happening every day.
How do you manage to do this work? It's very, very difficult.
All what is happening, when you see a human being is suffering and you need to do something to help them, to save them actually, if you can save someone, you have to do it.
Have you lost any friends yourself in this tragedy?
Actually, I lost 2 friends 9th of July. 2 of my staff were killed by an airstrike. They rushed to the location for bombing, and when they tried to pull the wounded people, another airstrike hit them and killed them. One of them killed immediately with the other one, lost his hand and lost his leg. Then he died in the hospital.
Has your own home been affected? Are you living in a different place than you were a couple years ago because of the bombing of Aleppo?
Most of the people in Aleppo City are displaced. They move. If this neighborhood was bombed, they moved to another neighborhood. Actually, I moved 3 times. I moved from house to another because of the bombing.
Ishmael, my last question is, in Syria, in your own situation, are there any people you consider heroes through this very difficult time?
I can consider everyone who's staying in Aleppo City and all Syria. They are all heroes in this situation, this bombing, this killing. All of them are heroes.
29-year-old Ishmael Al-Abdullah speaking to us from Aleppo, Syria, where he is a White Helmet volunteer. Thank you so much, Ishmael.
Thank you.
What if a young girl went missing in your neighborhood? Would you help with the search? Put up posters? Would you expect the police to be organizing a task force to find her? That's what should happen. But in Canada, Aboriginal girls and women have been going missing for decades. And in many cases, the police are accused of not doing enough to find them. Now the Canadian government has launched an inquiry to look into the high rates of violence against Indigenous women and girls throughout Canada. Connie Walker is a reporter for the CBC. She joins us from Toronto. Connie, I've read that Aboriginal women and girls in Canada are 5 times more likely to die violently than non-Indigenous women. What's going on?
I think there are a number of things at play, but you're absolutely right in terms of the disproportionate rates of violence faced by Indigenous women and girls across the country. You know, regardless of the nation or the province or the territory, I think that what this inquiry is aiming to do is to take a look at some of the root causes of this issue and try to propose some concrete solutions to help address it.
A report was issued that in some ways, I think, motivated Justin Trudeau to set up the inquiry. It put the number of indigenous girls and women killed between 1980 and the present at 1,200. Give us a sense of what that means in terms of the percentage of people in Canada that are indigenous.
About 5 or 6 years ago, there were advocacy groups, women, Native women's organizations in Canada, that were estimating the number was 500. And back then, that was seen as shocking. It was seen as a shocking number, too high to be believed. And now, you know, not that many years later, to have the RCMP, the National Police Force, say it's actually 1,200 was, I think, definitely a shocking wake-up call for a lot of Canadians who may not have been familiar with the issue, even though it's been ongoing in Indigenous communities for so long. And earlier this year, the Liberal government, which called the National Inquiry actually last December, they decided to split it up into two phases. So phase one of the inquiry was actually traveling to communities, Indigenous communities across the country, and holding pre-inquiry consultations to hear from family members and advocates about what they wanted in a national inquiry. And they said that they used that information to help shape what was announced yesterday. But it's certainly been an ongoing issue for a long time, but really has only, you know, grabbed the national attention and the national spotlight in the last couple of years.
What is the assignment of this inquiry? What are they supposed to do and who gets to be part of it?
In general, it's focused on trying to stop this national tragedy, which their attempt is to identify some of the historic or institutional patterns at play that are putting Indigenous women at risk or making them more likely to become victims of violent acts. Also, I think that it's important to say that, you know, I think that there are many different ideas about what this inquiry should accomplish.
Based on what is known about these missing women and those who have been killed, what are the circumstances which makes them especially vulnerable?
It has to be looked at in the bigger context of the history of Indigenous people and the history of colonization in Canada, the legacies of residential schools. It was government policy for over 100 years to take Indigenous children away from their homes and house them in residential boarding schools where they were not allowed to speak their language or practice their culture. Many experienced severe and horrific physical and sexual abuse. Just the lasting legacies of residential schools and how communities are still dealing with it. And one of the manifestations of that is this issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. I think that, you know, it really has to be looked at under this bigger picture of colonization in Canada.
Connie Walker is a reporter for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
We're going to stay in Canada now, but head west to a patch of wilderness on the Pacific coast known as the Great Bear Rainforest. We heard yesterday about the grueling 20-year negotiations to limit the logging in the Great Bear. If you missed it, you can find that story at PRI.org. Today, we look at some of the great bears that live in the Great Bear Rainforest, specifically grizzly bears, and a new agreement that will let more of them stay alive. Here's the world's Andrea Crossan.
It's not a comfortable ride on this tiny seaplane to get to the Great Bear Rainforest, but it's worth it. Between the wing and the pontoon, below me are giant cedar forests, island archipelagos, and blue-green fjords stretching out to glacier-capped mountains. I've been told I might see gray wolves, cougars, mountain goats, humpback whales, and, of course, bears. Grizzly bears in particular. And before long, I do. The small outboard boat I'm in is floating along the estuary of the Nikite River. It's a cloudless morning, and just beyond the bow, there's rustling of trees and the sound of branches snapping. I'm holding my microphone as far out as I can so that I can record this. A male grizzly on shore about 15 yards away. My guide here is Tom Rivest.
That is a sound that's called either chuffing or huffing. Sounds a little bit like, you know, bellows expelling air. The bears do that when they're stressed or excited or a little both, which they probably are.
The reason this bear is excited is that it's mating season and he's following a female and her two cubs. Rivest has been taking tourists to this spot for 15 years, so he knows this bear. He calls it Bo Diddley.
Bo and I go back 10 years. So he was just a little scrawny thing back then. And now, as we get closer, you'll see he's quite large.
How big is he?
He's probably an 800-pound bear. I don't know. He will get larger, but he is bigger than most.
Bears like Bo Diddley are a big draw for tourists paying top dollar to see them. But there's another type of tourist looking for bears here. Before I came here, I called up a guide to see what draws his customers.
They're world class as far as size and weight and skull measurement.
Skull measurement. That's one of the criteria for guides like Peter Clowey. He owns a hunting license for a huge swath of the Great Bear Rainforest. Hey. That's sound from a YouTube video of one of Clowey's clients killing a bear. Clowey's current license allows the hunting of 23 bears over 5 years. Hunters pay him upwards of $20,000 for a trip here. But like the logging that we heard about yesterday, the hunting culture here may be winding down. Earlier this year, the British Columbia government officially endorsed the practice of conservation groups buying hunting licenses from guides like Peter Clowey. And it's actually something that's been done unsanctioned for years.
We just went and did it.
Chris Genovalli heads the Raincoast Conservation Foundation. The group helps raise the millions of dollars needed to buy the hunting licenses. They already own rights to about a third of the Great Bear Rainforest. Genovalli is no fan of hunting in general, but he says it's particularly cruel to hunt grizzlies here because they're out in the open, grazing in estuaries or following the salmon run.
It's like someone walking into your kitchen or your dining room as you're eating breakfast or dinner and shooting you, you know? It's obscene. It's becoming viewed by an overwhelming majority of the public as a fringe behavior.
Genovalli points to a recent poll in which only 10% of those who responded supported trophy hunting. But there's sort of a wink and a nod in conservationists' new deal with the government. In order to buy the hunting licenses, his group has to use them.
We've had to show what's called commercial activity.
Once a year, they take out tourists for a fake hunt.
We take clients on hunts in our guide outfitting territories, and we look for bears. The difference is we shoot them with cameras.
The government has also agreed to an outright end to commercial grizzly bear hunting in some native territory in the Great Bear. So the pressure is clearly on hunting guides here. But Peter Clowey says he isn't worried about his business.
Well, nothing has changed since that announcement, and I don't expect anything to change.
Clowey says he's still getting calls from hunters, but he also says he's planning to retire soon and might sell his license. And he might even sell it to a conservation or Aboriginal group if they offered him the most money.
If they want to eliminate or slow down hunting of carnivores in the Great Bear Rainforest, they can do like anybody else and offer to buy out the business, just like on Wall Street.
One eagle heading south, just went past the top of Center Slough, coming down the river.
Back on the Nikite River, Tom Rivest gets word from another guide that the mother grizzly and her cubs that Bo Diddley is pursuing have moved farther up the estuary. Bo and the other bears are safe from hunters here. The Raincoast Foundation owns the commercial hunting rights. The area is also off limits to local resident hunters. Rivest says that's important because these bears have become used to humans.
The biggest issue with viewing and hunting is bears become used to being around people and they no longer have that innate fear, so it is really not fair to hunt them.
And that's what the debate about hunting here really comes down to, fairness and values. The BC government estimates there are around 15,000 grizzlies in the province. Overall, hunters kill between 250 and 300 bears per year. So it's not like they're endangered. It's more that the social clock seems to be running out on commercial hunting. For the grizzlies along the Nikite River, humans don't seem to be a threat. If Bo Diddley was afraid of us, he didn't show it. He looked more concerned with where that female grizzly was headed. For the World, I'm Andrea Crossan, the Great Bear Rainforest, British Columbia.
If you want to see photos of Bo Diddley and some of the other grizzlies of the Great Bear Rainforest, and trust me, you do, they're all up at PRI.org. And coming up here on the radio, why playing funk in Rio could get you arrested. You're listening to The World. Rio's getting ready for tomorrow night's big opening ceremony. Lots of nervous athletes, I'm sure. Our BBC colleague Julia Carneo is from Rio, and she's been profiling some locals who are going for the gold. Julia visited one of them at wrestling practice.
I've come to meet athlete Joyce Silva. She's 33 years old, wearing a bright yellow Brazil shirt, and she's one of four Brazilian women who qualified for the Olympics in wrestling. Especially excited to compete in her hometown, Rio.
I'm Carioca, born and raised in Rio de Janeiro. When Rio was chosen to be the Olympic host city, it seemed like a dream. I couldn't believe it. I'm taking my preparation one day at a time. I try to focus on what I have to do today, so I'm ready on the day of my fight. Train hard, do my best. That's what I've been doing.
Joyce became a hero to all her colleagues here after winning the first medal for Brazil in wrestling in the Pan American Games. Now the fight is on for the first Olympic medal for wrestling.
It was a huge achievement. I was so happy. On the podium, I couldn't hold back. I cried so much. The Olympic medal would be a dream come true.
It's not easy being an athlete in Brazil, she says. There's lack of support, especially at a grassroots level.
For athletes in Brazil, it always comes a time when children have to decide between studying and sport. Shouldn't be that way. There should be incentives for both things to walk hand in hand. There's still little support from the government for sport.
Female wrestling is a young sport in the Olympics. The first competition was in 2004, and Joyce's career started just a few years before that, when she was 19 years old.
As a woman, I believe I end up being a model for girls who keep hearing that they can do this or that because they are girls. So it's important to show that with hard work, you can do it.
Wrestler Joyce Da Silva ending that report by the BBC's Julia Carneo in Rio. Tomorrow's opening ceremony for the Rio Olympics is sure to feature lots of great Brazilian music. That includes one kind of music that many Rio residents love, even though they can sometimes get arrested for playing it. Catherine Osborne has that story.
To get Brazilians excited about the Olympics, Rio City government commissioned a countdown song.
Rio de Janeiro, essa é a nossa casa, cidade maravilhosa, recebe jogos com a sua graça.
Specifically, a funk carioca song. It's a popular genre of electronic music.
Porque funk é a da cultura do Rio de Janeiro.
Because funk is the culture of Rio de Janeiro, says one of the song's writers and singers, Gabriela Vieira. It tells the story of the things we live through here, she adds.
Por mais que a nossa cultura é algo que nos suprime a fazer.
But, she says, ironically, it also faces heavy oppression. Funk carioca began in the 80s, when local artists, known as MCs, started singing over tracks of Miami bass music. They invented irreverent rhymes about daily life, and the scene developed at dance parties called bailes in Rio's poor neighborhoods, favelas.
Cultura traz esse pertencimento. Antes do funk,
MC Leonardo says funk encouraged young people from favelas to get out in the city and experience the joy of getting to know different parts of it. But when the scene got really big in the 90s, police started to raid funk parties, claiming there were drug traffickers there. Sometimes that was true. But critics say, even so, the way funk is treated reveals a double standard in Rio's war on drugs.
So it's a selective repression and disproportionate.
Guilherme Pimentel is a lawyer at a civil rights nonprofit. He says, number one, police don't raid parties in rich neighborhoods where there are plenty of drugs. And number two, in poor neighborhoods, authorities are often most interested in extorting party planners for bribes in exchange for looking the other way. Pimentel has documented over a dozen cases in which police have shot or destroyed sound equipment worth thousands of dollars. Social worker Rosana Lopes was at a daytime funk event last month that got shut down by the police because organizers didn't have a special permit, despite turning in the required paperwork weeks in advance. She thinks funk wouldn't be so repressed by the authorities if it weren't so powerful. Some Brazilian funk songs tell stories of racism, segregation, and police repression. And, on the flip side, of local pride, creativity, and solidarity. Recently, for example, a funk MC released a song about how Brazil's rich, corrupt politicians get to plea bargain their way out of jail, unlike the poor. And there's a funk about the Olympics that the government didn't sponsor.
Contagem regressiva para os jogos, maior número de corpos, medalha de caveirão.
It's by MC Manoteco, who says the games have robbed many Rio residents of their homes through evictions and failed to deliver improvements to the city's poor public services. Meanwhile, despite a 2009 law that specifically outlawed discrimination against funk, the crackdown on funk parties continues weekly.
Os MCs que fizeram antigamente hoje não fazem mais. Por quê? Porque não tem caminho metodológico.
Deco says it's so hard in Rio for funk artists that many are now going to Sao Paulo to perform because they feel more welcome there. And he says that has an impact on the local economy too, because holding a party in a favela also supports a lot of jobs on the side.
O dono de equipe, os carregadores de caixa de som.
Like the guys who run the sound equipment, local food vendors, even the local barbers have more business that day, says Teco. And the list goes on. Rio's funk community continues to fight back, though. One example is a group of funk organizers who used to compete with each other, but are now working together to hold special bailes in community centers across the city. Like this one, in the north side neighborhood of Braz de Pina on a recent Sunday night. The sound system was stacked 12 feet high, pyrotechnics shot down from the ceiling, and people belted the funk anthem of that particular neighborhood. The night was a success. Rosana Lopes, the social worker, points to events like this one when she says the government commissioning a funk song about the Olympics is nowhere close to giving funk the space it legally deserves.
Eu sugeriria aquela questão de ser sujeito político.
Lopes says that would boost not only local economies, but also citizenship, with more ways to demand respect and even bigger changes in society. For The World, I'm Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro.
Eu acho que o senhor tá cometendo uma falha. Se dançamos funk, é porque somos funkeiros. Da favela carioca, flamenguistas brasileiros. Mas não me bate, doutor, porque eu sou de batalha. Eu acho que o senhor tá cometendo uma falha. Se dançamos funk, é porque somos funkeiros. Da favela carioca.
A little funk from Rio brings our show to a close today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.